it away.
Well, thank you so much, Dale. And I'm delighted to be here. I'm kind of tickled that something like this exists, because I didn't know a lot about this until Dale started telling me, and I'm impressed by the intentionality that the center puts into this time together. They started talking to me about this a year ago, and they wanted to talk about themes and content, and Ina Grace has put this Bible study together. And they worked real carefully with Tom to put together a worship plan, and I just don't know that I've been part of a conference that was so well planned. I end up popping in and out of a lot of conferences. You know, they just, some places they don't even tell you what to talk about. They just say come, and that's fine with me too. But it's good to be part of something that's this well organized and planned. So I'm delighted to be here. And I'm delighted to be getting to know this Center for Parish Development community a little bit better. I also wanted to say, just in front of all of y'all here, how pleased I am to get to do this with Tom. This is the first time we've gotten to do something like this together. But I don't even know if Tom remembers, but a decade ago, when my wife and I were, 10 years younger than we are now, we wandered into Vancouver to see what was going on with the church there, and we stumbled into this little church, and we met this couple that were extremely hospitable to us, so hospitable in fact that several years later, when my best friend in the world, the guy I grew up with, was moving to Vancouver, I remembered. I said, you gotta go see these people, Tom and Karen. You gotta find them. And sure enough, he showed up. They gave him a place to stay, and he stayed with them till he found a home. Bless his heart. He didn't make big plans ahead of time, and he joined their church out there in Vancouver. Met a wonderful woman that he's now married to, and it's how life goes. So I'm grateful for Tom, not only as an incredible worship leader, which you've experienced, but a great person. It's good to be here together with all of y'all. Tom and Dale both talked a little bit about how part of the plan of this thing is to see how our reflections and our thinking about church and what it means to be church and to be a community in the way of Jesus today is deeply rooted, not just in our thinking, but in our worship and in our interaction with Scripture. And as I was thinking these past few days about our time here together and about exactly where to begin, I think it was somewhat serendipitous that we came to a passage in Bible study at my home church last night that really brought it home to me. So right out of worship, this came to me. I'll have to tell you a little bit about my church for this Bible study to have a context. But I live in Durham, North Carolina. Durham is a southern city in lots of ways. We're delighted about the movement of the New South in the South these days, and you'll hear a lot about that if you come down south. It ain't the South it used to be. They're saying this all over the place. And yet, we are, in so many ways, still a classically segregated town. And so our church is a black church in a black neighborhood in Durham, and it has been that way for over 100 years. And yet it's a wonderful congregation that has been welcoming to people like me. Sometimes when I tell people I'm an associate minister at a black church, they look at me a little funny, and I say, "What? You've never seen a light-skinned brother?" But no, I am in fact white, and still talk a little bit like a redneck, which is where I come from. But this church, even despite the division that manifests in our histories, this church has been incredibly welcoming, and so I've been a minister there for some years, and our family was just members of it before that. And anyway, we were reading the Bible together last night. We do this on Wednesday nights after we take a good bit of time to sing songs and give praise and testimony, which can sometimes take a good hour or so. We do get around to the Bible, and we were reading this passage last night a fascinating passage that has often troubled me in Luke 19. And y'all preachers, y'all might have had to try to preach this one before. You know this parable of the minas. You know where the Jesus tells this story. It's right after Zacchaeus. You know, is up in the tree, and we sing about that. And then Jesus, you know, goes to his home, and Zacchaeus has this radical conversion experience that gets right down to the stuff of his life, the real material stuff, the money that he was in the business of dealing with. He says if he's wronged anyone, that he's going to return it to them four times what he stole from them. And then it's fascinating. If you have a Bible, take a look at this. I think this story. So important to get it in context, because it's, I'm afraid, so often misread. It's just after that encounter with Zacchaeus that Luke tells us, while they were listening to this exchange that Jesus was having with Zacchaeus, Jesus went on to tell them a parable, because he was near Jerusalem, and the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. Luke has already told us that Jesus has set his face like a flint toward Jerusalem. Jerusalem being that center of the kingdom that everybody knows. And yet Jesus is a king, a different kind of king who wants to bring a different kind of kingdom. And so he tells this story. It's a story about a man of noble birth who went to a distant country to have himself appointed king and then to return. And you know this story. I won't read it all to you. But this man of noble birth who goes away, his people don't like him. And this is clear to everyone. They don't want him to be king. You know he's going away somewhere else to be crowned king because this is the Roman Empire, you see. And the Roman Empire endorses their own puppet kings that they like in these places, and you got to go to Washington D.C. I mean, you got to go to Rome to get your stamp of approval to be king of this place. Well, when he's on his way out, he says that he's going to entrust his people with these resources, and so he says, he called 10 of his servants, gave them 10 minas. He says, put this money to work until I come back. But his subjects hated him. And they sent a delegation after him to say, we don't want this man to be our king. He's made king anyway. And he returned home. And then he sent the servants to whom he'd given the money in order to find out what they had done with it. And so they come. The first one says, I took it, made 10 more. He loves that. This is a good return. The next one took it and got 5 more. That's great. But then this last one comes. This last fellow comes and says, sir, here's your mina. I've kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. I was afraid of you because you are a hard man. You take out what you did not put in and you reap what you did not sow. His master replied, I'll judge you by your own words, you wicked servant. You knew, did you, that I'm a hard man, taking what I did not put in and reaping what I did not sow. Why then didn't you put my money on deposit? So that when I came back, I could have collected it with interest. We read the King James Version at our church, so last night we read that. It said, so that I could have collected it with usury. That's what began to tip me off, with what's going on here. And then he said to those standing by, take his mina away from him and give it to the one who has 10. Sir, they said, he already has 10. Come on. Ah, he said, I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given. But as for the one who has nothing, even what he has will be taken away. Now, y'all know how this passage often gets read in churches. What I said to the congregation last night was, y'all know how white people often read this. You know, we all have our gifts. And we're responsible for being faithful with our gifts. And when you read it that way, you know there's some moral lesson about how you ought to take care of the things that you've been given, which is, you know, what my dad taught me when we wash the car on Saturdays. And that's all fine and good. I'm not opposed to taking care of the things that are given you. But that's not what this story is about. Because if you read the story that way, then this terrible ruler, this terrible king, is God in the story. And I don't want to serve that God. And nobody who was listening to Jesus would have served that God either. And this is what I told him last night. I said, just look at verse 26. Now, you got to know the crowd. You got to know the crowd. These are African Americans who've lived in the South for all of their lives. A lot of our congregation is older. Everybody there was on board with the civil rights movement, depending on what risk they were willing to take. They were involved in different ways. But everybody there knew that it was good news. And so what I said was, here's how we know for sure. Here's how we know for sure that this is not God. Because in verse 26 he said, I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given. But as for the one who has nothing, even what he has will be taken away. I said, who does that sound like? That's the Republicans. I said, you know it can't be God if he's talking like a Republican. And everybody said, amen, brother. Amen. But if the story is not about being faithful with the gifts or the resources that have been invested in, what is the story about? Why is Jesus telling this story? Well, it occurred to me as we were studying this last night and talking through it, that this is really what our time here together is about. This is a story that Jesus tells on his way into Jerusalem to make it clear to a crowd that doesn't like this kind of king that he's a different kind of king who brings a different kind of kingdom, and that kingdom entails with it a whole different way of life. It's a different way of bringing transformation in the world. So it's not just that we have a different imagination for what the world could be. It's not just that we want a revolution, but it's that God teaches us a different way of bringing it about. And that's the core of what the book of Ephesians, I think, is about. That our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but it's against the principalities and powers. And once we realize that we've been caught up in the story of God and how God is overcoming those powers, then we're invited to embody a different way. Well, we're going to get more into Bible study later, but I wanted to share that as a way of just introducing what I would like to do in these talks. This has something to do with my own personal story. I grew up in the South on the other side of our racial divide. I grew up in a little place called King, North Carolina, that's out in tobacco country. And I was raised there by Southern Baptists, good Southern Baptist people, who taught me to love Jesus and memorize the Bible in the King James Version, because if it was good enough for Jesus, it was good enough for us. We were clear on that. And in that context, I wanted to do all that I could for Jesus. You know, I knew who Jesus was. I knew what Jesus had done for me and for the whole world. And I wanted to do all I could for Jesus. And in the 1980s, when I was growing up, the best thing I could imagine to do for Jesus was to become President of the United States. That was my goal in life. Jimmy Carter had done it. He was a Baptist. I thought I would do it too. And so I was going to follow his path. I was going to go to the U.S. Naval Academy. And so I, in junior high school, I got up early every morning, did my push-ups. You know, I was getting ready. I was in shape. I was trying to do my homework, do well in school. And then I learned, it was a devastating thing when I learned this, little town guy that I was, I learned that you have to have a senator's recommendation to go to the Naval Academy. And I didn't know any senators. And I thought, what am I going to do? But then my grandfather, who drove Greyhound bus, he gave me a ride to Washington, D.C. when I was out of school one time. And I went to the Senate building and I looked around and I found out that there were young people walking around on the floor. They were wearing blue blazers, but they looked like me. And I said, who are these people? I asked the security guard, and he said, they're Senate pages. And I thought, that's my first step. I've got to become a Senate page. So I wrote letters, and I figured out how to become a page, and I got myself appointed as a page to Senator Strom Thurmond when I was a 16-year-old kid in high school. And so I went to Washington, D.C., and I was on my way. I knew it. I knew where I was headed, and I knew how I was going to get there. It was going to take a lot of hard work, but I had the energy. Let me tell you, I was by that time I was getting up at 4 a.m. to, of course, do my quiet time before I went on to do my schoolwork, so I could get to the office by 9 o'clock and do important things like carry papers from one building to the next for the center. But it was an exciting time. I was rooming with a congressman's son. I was living on Capitol Hill. I was wearing these. Well, these two suits that my dear parents had bought me to wear to the big city, one day, one the next, then back to it again. And yet, I thought I was getting somewhere so fast. And one day, at lunch, I was moving very fast. Everything was moving very fast then because we were important people in Washington, D.C. I learned that very quickly by example. Everybody was so important. You had to move fast and you couldn't pause often for people, and so I was running to get lunch at Union Station, a little train station down the hill from Capitol Hill. They had a food court there. I was going to go eat, and on the way into the train station, I passed this guy who was holding a styrofoam cup. He asked if I could spare some change, and I completely ignored the guy. Just kept going. I wasn't sure what to do. We didn't have people sitting on the street in Keene, North Carolina. I grew up with poor folk. All of us were pretty poor, but we didn't have folks like that. And so I was going in the door there, and I heard the voice of Jesus speak to me in the King James Version that I had memorized. And he said, "Inasmuch as ye did not do unto the least of these, my brethren, ye did not do it unto me." And what I knew from my raisin, what my people taught me, was that if Jesus says something, you got to do it. So I knew I had to do something. I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do, but at the moment, all I could think to do was to go back to my dorm room where I was staying there on Capitol Hill and grab a $20 bill, and I reached into the box of Billy Graham tracks that my family had sent me to the big city with, and I wrapped a $20 bill around a Billy Graham track and stuck it in that guy's cup. I'm not suggesting this as a form of evangelism. I'm just saying it's the best thing I could think to do at the time. And that experience was an interruption to me. It was an interruption to my easy assumptions about how God works in the world and how I can get in on it. And I believe that was the beginning of the end of my political career, but also the beginning of an exciting journey in trying to learn, together with a lot of other people, what God is doing in the world today, what the kingdom looks like in our lives, in our neighborhoods, in our communities, in our congregations, in our country, and how we are to go about pursuing it. And so I just wanted to give a few thoughts to begin us here, a kind of a sketch of the landscape that I see in our culture today. What's going on with these various movements that are stirring in the church and on the margins of the church and sometimes beyond the church, but that I find very hopeful. I want to say that I really do think we have the early stirrings of a revival in this country. And I mean that in the classic sense that evangelicals like myself, what we know is that when the gospel connects with a person's deep need, what happens is conversion. Right? Your pastors, even if you're not an evangelical, you've probably seen that happen. Right, somebody has a real need in their life, and God meets them there, and it's a transformation in their life. At the same time, when that gospel touches on a deep need in our society, revival happens. I don't mean like the revival meeting that little churches in the South still plan, every fall, where we're gonna have 3 days of revival or 5 days. No, I mean the experience that the church has had at different times in its history of a genuine stirring that begins to change society. I'm thinking about America's first civil rights movement, that great civil rights movement of the 19th century that led to the abolition of slavery in this country. It was a great faith-based movement that stirred from a lot of sectors. It was Quakers and it was evangelicals and it was black folks all coming together because of what God was doing and creating a revival. I think whenever the gospel and the good news of what God is doing in the world touches on a deep need that is felt by by many of us, because it's not just a personal need, but a societal need. I think revival begins to stir. And it seems to me that there are lots of movements in the church right now that are pointing toward the same need. So I wanted to sketch a few of these out, because they don't all seem to be working in the same direction. You might not even like all of these movements, but let me just sketch a few things that I see happening. In a neighborhood like mine, a low-income neighborhood in this country, everywhere I go, not just in my neighborhood, but everywhere I've been in low-income neighborhoods in this country over the past decade, there's a huge popularity of this health and wealth gospel. Y'all know what I'm talking about? Turn on your TV, and you're going to find people like Joel Osteen, Creflo Dollar, T.D. Jakes, preaching something to the effect that God has a great life, and He has it for you right now. And often these people who preach this are icons of what they think the good life is. That is to say, they drive big fancy cars, they wear fancy suits, their shoes are real shined. I mean, you know, shined like you get a glare off of them when you look at them. This is a movement that has somewhat mystified me, because we work day in and day out with poor people who struggle to make ends meet, and I go into their house and I see them watching this, and I see their mail, and I see that they've got the mailing there from this or that ministry, and you don't get that mailing unless you mail something in. You know what I'm saying? These people are sending a little bit of the money they have to these people who are preaching what seems like craziness to me sometimes. But that has caused me to reflect on this a great deal. And what I've come to realize is that these people are partly right. Osteen, Jakes, what they have in common, and what's partly right, is this. God does have something for us in the here and now. And I think that there are many communities in this country, many communities in our culture, that have been, they've been delivered such an over-spiritualized gospel for so long that they're desperate for something that's concrete and that's material and that's real in the here and now. And so they're jumping on this stuff. Now, is what they're preaching the way of Jesus? I don't believe so. But I believe it's a reaction against something else that's also not the way of Jesus in a way that points us toward the truth. Another example, again, something that I'm somewhat uncomfortable with, but that I think is significant on the landscape of American religion right now, is the rapid growth of immigrant churches, and immigrant churches that, if you go there and listen to the messages that are preached or how people talk about their lives, are pretty legalistic. Pretty legalistic. I have a friend named Soon Chan Ra, who has written a very good book called The Next Evangelicalism. And what he says in that book, I think this is sobering for all of evangelicals. I mean, those of you who come from mainline traditions will appreciate this. What he says in the book is that for a long time, there's been kind of a public recognition of what's sometimes called the decline of the mainline, right? The mainline is losing numbers. This is decades in the making now. People have been talking about this for a while. And evangelicals have stood up proud and said, we're holding our numbers. We're holding them pretty well. You know, with our mega churches and this and that, we're doing pretty well. However, Sumsha has done the research and has looked at the numbers. And what he says is that if you just looked at white evangelicalism, it's on decline too. What's actually keeping evangelicals' numbers up is immigrant churches. Immigrant communities, and these communities that if you spend time in them, you'll often find that their message can be fairly legalistic. I've spent some time reflecting on what is it that makes these so attractive to people. And the more I get to know folks in our neighborhood and in other communities who are living in the midst of this immigration crisis that we have in this country. It is a crisis. It's important to realize. We're facing an immigration crisis. And if you want to understand that it's a crisis, just do what a group from Durham did a few years ago. I got to be part of it. We went to the border in Arizona, and we spent a week looking at the wall that's being built with leftover landing strips from the Vietnam War. a literal wall, 9-10 feet tall, solid iron, all the way through the desert. Because some people are desperate to keep folks out. And yet some folks are just as desperate to come. They're risking their lives to come to the desert. When we were there in the summer of 2006, 5,000 people had died in that desert trying to cross. It's a desperate situation. And yet, these people who are living here in this country are flocking to church. And flocking to church often in an unquestioned, extremely ordered, almost legalistic religious experience. I think because what they find there is a clear articulation of what it can mean to be legal. What it can mean to be legal in the eyes of God in a society where they're being told that their very existence is illegal. We spent some time with some of these folks who were working for the DREAM Act. I don't know if any of your communities had these folks pass through, but they called themselves the Dreamers, and they were young people from communities all over this country. And the DREAM Act was for them. It was for people who were brought to this country as children, brought by parents who didn't have documentation, and so both they and their parents are considered illegal. And yet a lot of these kids don't even really speak Spanish. They don't know anything about the countries they came from. In some cases, they don't have any papers for the countries they came from either. And so when they graduate high school, at present in this country, they have no legal way to proceed with life. And so the DREAM Act said that, well, if you sign up for college, or if you join the military, or if you join a service corps, you could get a fast track to a green card. Our Senate said no to that last winter. And yet these people are an important sign of the desperation that is real for so many of their family members, that they've become public in part because they have no other option. And yet they represent so many people. I think this is another important religious movement to pay attention to. Because though it may seem too legalistic, I think it's another articulation of the deep hunger for what I want to call a more material faith. A faith that recognizes that stuff matters. The stuff of our lives. The material conditions of our lives. Indeed, that God cares about the material conditions of our lives. At the same time, there are other movements that are happening, and most of these movements are movements of young people who come from positions of some privilege in this country, and I would certainly count myself among those. You may have seen, it depends on your ecclesial camp, just what these movements are being called, right? Especially coming out of the mainline traditions, sometimes these movements are being sketched as progressives. Or emergence. Some emergents are also post-evangelicals, and so there's a bit of mixing up that happens there. The kind of community that I'm part of and that others like our community identify with is sometimes called a new monastic movement or a rooting in this tradition of monastic renewal. There's lots of different expressions of this. And yet, I like our friend Tony Campolo, who Dale mentioned, Eastern University. Eastern University is a great place. I love it. I went to school there. And Tony Campolo was one of our teachers there. He has, in the last few years, gathered several of us together around an umbrella name. This is an organization. It's not trying to organize these different things. We're trying to say that we all have this in common. He calls us the Red Letter Christians. He says, if you have one of those old Bibles, you know, one of those old Bibles that has the red letters of Jesus, what these people have in common is that they believe the red letters have something to say about how we should live in the here and now. And I think that this is another movement or conglomeration of movements that has in common with the revival that's happening in immigrant churches, with the revival that's happening in the health and wealth movement. They all have this in common: a deep desire for a material spirituality for a good life in the here and now. And this is what I want to pay attention to. To pay attention to this longing that so many feel in our society that the church say something about how we live and about how that makes a difference for the social conditions that so many of us are facing. So, my own experience of this and take on it is that this revival is a manifestation of a transition that's happening in the church. And church historians have lots of ways of sketching the transitions that the church has been through. One of our friends who has been talking about this in recent years, her name is Phyllis Tickle, and she wrote a book called The Great Emergence. She talks about it, and I think this is a nice way of kind of summing it up. She says, every 500 years, the church has a rummage sale. and what we have to do is pull all the old stuff out of the basement and the closets and figure out, like Jesus said, that the householder takes out of the treasure chest some things old and some things new. And we got to figure out how do we re-tradition ourselves to face the present times, and how do we bring in the things that are new to remain faithful to what God is doing in the present. I think that there are these patterns. There have been these patterns of church renewal. A lot of our different denominations and church traditions come out of the different movements that have happened, whether it was the Protestant Reformation or the Great Schism that happened before that, these huge transitions that have happened in the church. But from my perspective, from the perspective of our small community that is, you know, in all ways on the margins of church life and even public life in our city, it's also striking to me that if we pay attention to church history, that at every period of great transition that the church has been through, there has also been a monastic renewal. All the way back to the first monastic movement in the Egyptian desert, beginning in the 3rd and 4th centuries, there were, as Christianity was moving from a minority movement that had been persecuted by emperors, and it begins to move to something that's more accepted with the Emperor Constantine. The church is given tax breaks, for which we continue to be grateful. And yet, there's a huge shift that happens in the 80 years between Constantine and Theodosius. By the time Theodosius is emperor, you have to be a Christian to be a member of the Roman military. That's a huge shift from persecution to sort of established religion. And in that great transition that the church faced, what has sometimes been called the Constantinian shift, that's when the first monastic movement was born in Egypt. Antony of the Desert, of course, is the most well-remembered, but there were people who preceded Antony, and certainly lots who came after him when his example was raised as an example of what it can mean to reconsider what faithfulness looks like in a new context. The monastic movement was extremely important. Important not just for those who joined it, but important as a minority movement within the church that was given space to experiment with practices of faithfulness that would later inform the whole church. And that initial monastic movement established a pattern whereby marginal movements throughout the church's history have continued to be almost free spaces for experimentation, for exploration of what it means to live the gospel in a new time and place. There is, of course, the Benedictine movement that rises up in Europe in the midst of the Dark Ages, a huge societal transformation that's happening, and the Benedictine communities emerge as little pockets of light in the midst of the Dark Ages. You know, little communities where people were living an alternative way of life. Whether it's the desert or the Benedictines or the Franciscan and mendicant movement that comes in the midst of the Middle Ages with the rise of the middle class and the consideration of a new economy. And here's Francis, who reminds us that God is a beggar and we're beggars too, in a sense, in a great alternative to to some of the economic changes that were happening at the time. This pattern of monastic renewal, I think, has been hugely important in the church's history, and has become important to communities like ours as we've tried to consider what our vocation is. So I'm over the next couple of days going to share stories with you all and reflect a bit on what we can learn out of some of these stories that are coming out of communities like this. And yet I put it in this context to say, I hope that that these communities don't exist for themselves, and that in relationship with the church, I've almost come to think about these new monastic communities as little laboratories. Little laboratories where, by the graciousness of many, many people, including the people in our congregations, we've been given the freedom to experiment with what practices of the faith can look like. That's a great gift. It's a great gift to us to have that freedom, to not have to be responsible for all the things that you who are pastors and bishops and area ministers and such are responsible for. I couldn't do what I do if I had to do what you do. I wouldn't have the time to write, nor would I have the time to live in the very simple and experimental way that we're living. It's been a great gift from the church to be able to do that. And yet, on the other side, I think what the church, what the institution has often seen, is that what happens in these free spaces, in these marginal, even what someone like Sally McFaig might call a wild space, in these wild spaces, is that we get a chance to see what new and emerging practices can look like. And part of what I want to point to in our time together is how the practices that are emerging in these communities don't only point to the reign of God where all things are reconciled and peace has come and there's justice and our problems are fixed, but that these practices are also pointing us to a distinct way of pursuing those ends, of pursuing God's ends. Like I think Jesus is pointing us to in Luke 19, we worship a king who has a different kind of kingdom, and yet the beginning of understanding that kingdom is understanding that it doesn't work like the rulers of the Gentiles do it, how they lord it over one another, how they say, I'm going to give you some money and you better use it to make me some more money. This kingdom doesn't use people to create some greater product, but rather, this is a kingdom where we learn from Jesus the incredible, self-giving, non-violent love of a God who is always giving God's self to God's selves. That's the doctrine of the Trinity that we confess. But that, in an incredible act of generosity, invites us into that giving and gives God's self to us and invites us to receive that and to pass it on to one another in community. And that, I think, invites us into a way of life. A way of life that's lived wherever we live as the people of God, but that these little communities that live together in households and day in and day out have a chance to experiment in the practices that make it possible. And so so I want us to be able to talk a little bit about that and reflect on it. But let me stop there. Let me stop there and say that's my own vision of where we're going, and all things are subject to change in this journey that we're on. But I wanted to lay that out for you and see if there's any feedback. Now I'm trusting Ina Grace to keep us on schedule because she's paying attention to the clock and I sometimes forget it. So you just tell me when we need to, well, when I need to shut up and sit down. You just tell me. But I would be glad for a little bit of conversation at this time just to get feedback from you about what you see, where you are, and whether any of this resonates with you. Or we can always sing some more.
Well, I could say, on the one hand, it gives me hope. On the other hand, when I try to think of how to move from there to where our church is, it kind of seems overwhelming.
Okay. What part gives you hope?
Well, that there are communities of people who are really attempting, just like in Thomas, his family moving on faith to live kind of an alternative life. I mean, that's hopeful.
Yeah. Yeah. In this regard, I am a Southern Baptist. I already told you, and one of the great gifts to Southern Baptists in the 20th century was Clarence Jordan. Did y'all ever come across him? Clarence grew up in the South in a different era. This is very definitely the Old South. In South Georgia, as the son of an established white family. And he said when he was growing up that reading the scriptures and living in the racialized society that he grew up in created a great tension in his soul. And he really spent most of his life trying to make sense of that and to see what God had to say to that. The striking thing about his witness and the witness of those who were with him was that in the midst of racial segregation that wasn't even really being challenged yet in the 1940s, they decided to start an interracial Christian community in Southwest Georgia. Now, very small. It was very small. It was often just a couple of families living there and asking neighbors to help them, you know, when it was harvest time and they needed more hands. But even when they first got started, Clarence told a story about how they were out there working and they would come into the table and they'd sit down together. Black folks and white folks had to eat together. And the Ku Klux Klan came out just shortly after they got there. Said they had heard about what they were doing out there. And as Clarence told the story, the Klansman said to him, "I just wanted to let you know that we don't let the sun set on people like you around here." And Clarence said, "I gave him my broadest smile and I said to them, 'Pleased to meet you, gentlemen. I've been waiting all my life to meet somebody who can make the sun stand still.'" He had a bit of a wit about him. But part of the audacity of that whole experiment was that it was completely unsustainable, completely inconceivable. You can talk about unsustainable. When the KKK realized that these folks were crazy, you know, that they didn't listen to reason, what they did was they instituted an economic boycott against them. So this is a farm in a rural community that could not buy or sell in the county where it existed. How is a farm like that going to survive? Well, they said, "We don't know, but God called us to this." And of course, they were witty, so they started a campaign. They called it the Ship the Nuts Out of Georgia campaign. You know, they raised pecans. So they started this mail order business where any church anywhere that believed in what they were doing would order the pecans by phone and they would mail them to them. By the way, when you are considering your holiday gifts this year, they still do it 80-some years later. So if you want to get a pecan pie, you can have it sent to your grandma straight from Koinonia Farm. Just go online. They have a website. At any rate, that's an incredible story to me of a group, a very small group, that against the odds, and when it seemed completely impossible, just kept doing what they knew God had called them to do. And it looked crazy to people. It seemed dangerous to a lot of the people who were there. I think Clarence Jordan died of a heart attack because it just weighed on him. It just weighed on him. So he dropped dead at his writing desk in his mid-50s. And yet, I think it's been an incredible gift to the church and to the world. Because, you know, the year before Clarence died, after he had stuck at that thing for 30-some years, the year before he died, there was this young couple that they actually read the same text that St. Anthony heard in church. That text that said, "Sell all that you have and give it to the poor." And like St. Anthony did, they said, "Well, I guess we got to do it." He was a lawyer. They had a nice home. They sold it all. He quit his job. And they didn't know what to do, but they had some friends who had been interns at Koinonia Farms, so they went by Koinonia Farms to see him. And they met this guy, Clarence Jordan, at dinner. And they said, this brother is crazy, but the Jesus he's talking about sounds a lot like the Jesus we just sold everything to follow. So they hung around. And in that time that they hung around, he captivated their imagination. And they had this simple little idea that everybody could have a home. And so they started this thing. You might have heard of it. It's called Habitat for Humanity. That came out of Koinonia Farm, out of this little experiment that was never more than a couple dozen people that, you know, was just trying to live the Koinonia they'd read about in the Bible, even though it didn't look like it could be lived in the South. It's one of those stories that gives me hope that these little things really do shape and transform all of our lives, and maybe we have to keep doing them, and maybe we have to keep exploring it where we are, even when we can't see how it's going to reshape something that looks like it can't change, like your congregation or your denomination or American Christianity, which sometimes I look at and say, oh my Lord.
Well, it's interesting that you say you're in this experimental laboratory, and I guess what I'm struggling with is I'm in a very established mainline setting. Uh-huh. It's like living with one foot in one world and one foot in another. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm wondering, is it through the practices that in an established setting that you begin to plant some seeds of this different way of life?
Yeah.
How transferable is it into an established situation?
Old world, right? So you take the old world to the new world.
The vocation of pastor in our particular cultural context, I take to be a near impossibility. In this regard, for those of you who are pastors, I would highly recommend the memoir that Eugene Peterson just published last year called The Pastor. If you've read any of Eugene's stuff, you know he's been thinking about being a pastor in this culture for a long time. But it's real personal here, because he talks about the struggle that he lived through of wanting to be a good manager, you know, wanting to have a successful church. And in a sense, achieving it, and then facing the depression that you face when you do achieve what you think you're supposed to do, and the kingdom still does not come. What are you going to do? Well, he was reading the Benedictines at the time, and they said, well, you just stay. And so he stayed. And anyway, he tells that whole story, and it's an important book, I think. But it's a reminder to me of how difficult this pastoral vocation is. I think it makes a huge difference. I think it makes all the difference in the world just who you're listening to. You know? Are you listening to, you know, the hottest new megachurch pastor and the model, you know, the simple three-step model of success that they've just put out through your denomination's publishing arm? Or are you listening to the Clarence Jordans, right? Are you listening, even in your town, to these odd little experiments that when you look at it, like when the people who started it come to you and say, will you be on our board? You say, it won't ever work. Like, you won't be able to raise money to do that. I don't think you can keep that thing going. It's not to say that every little careless experiment ought to become like the example. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that where we look for our models of success, I think should be radically shaped by this vision of a Jesus who looks at the kings and authorities that exist and says, "But y'all know y'all don't want to be ruled by those folks. They eat you up. I want to show you a better way. Okay? I want to show you that. Yeah."